You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot. CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls. Tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part four of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part four focuses on fences in our neighborhoods and backyards. This program is dedicated to people who try to help settle disputes over a backyard fence or a border wall.
My name is Kevin Wolf. I live in Davis, California. I graduated from UC Davis with a degree in evolution and ecology, and I stayed. And I was an organizer for Friends of the River for 10 years, and then I ran my own company for 20 years, helping with a complex consensus-based decision-making. And then I became the CEO of a wind turbine company. And I have been developing a startup wind turbine company that will make a big difference in the world. I volunteered on, you know, my Davis Food Co-op. I was the president of the board when we moved into the big store. I've been involved in lots of environmental groups, and I presently chair the Ocean Iron Fertilization Alliance. So that's some of my background. So UC Davis student, connected with a bunch of river rafters, and we started living together in a co-ed house, and then we moved into a five-bedroom house on N Street and turned it into a great student co-op. One day I see this guy on the roof of my neighbor's house, and I ask him, hey, are you the landlord? And he says, yeah. I said, could we buy this house from you? And he says, yeah, $5,000 over market and you can buy it. But you're gonna have to buy the house next door as well, because I own both houses and you hippies are ruining the neighborhood. So I had convinced my landlord, when he was going to sell the house, to figure out how I could buy it with my housemates. And none of my housemates would go in on it with me. And it took me a year and a half, and I ended up figuring out how to buy that house from him. So the five-bedroom co-op was mine. And now this is 2 years later, and my wife and I are going to get married, and she was looking to buy a house. And so the house next door for $5,000 over market, she wasn't going to spend $5,000 over market, but thank goodness for love and the argument that we could tear the fence down. So we bought the house and tore the fence down, and we had a big fence tearing down party. And in that fence tearing down party, the neighbor across the backyard looked over his fence, asked what we're doing, and ask if he could join us and tear his fence down. So, yeah, just get your landlord to agree. So that's pretty much the genesis of it. And 3 years later, we finally had a planned development in which no fences are allowed to go up in the backyard without consensus of all the neighbors. You can't block your neighbor from walking through your backyard, but your neighbor can't force you to do anything on your yard. It's your house. It's your yard. No one can tell you to put the trampoline on your yard but you can't put a fence to block your neighbors through your yard. And you can't build anything in the last 30 feet in your backyard. We used to joke about it being a house a year for 20 years. So we're at 20 houses and we don't have any fences in our backyards. We gave the planned development gave people an easier ability to build in the front yard, the side yards, and a second story. So that was the trade, and we have been fence-free ever since. We just got lucky that our housing built in the 1950s was kind of the first housing that put the bedrooms in the front yard facing the street and put the kitchen and the living room in the backyard. And they were the first houses that really had fences in town. And the idea at that mid-1950s is you have your lovely backyard with your lovely redwood fence, and your living space faces your backyard because that's where your kids are going to be playing and you're going to be hanging out. So there was this change in the design for many years where now the backyard is the focus with your fence up. So that's classic co-housing design. You want to be able to look into your neighbor's kitchen and living room from the common space. Wow, we lucked out. The way co-housing, it tries to set itself up so that people have to visit their neighbors. So for example, in a lot of co-housing communities, the mailboxes are in the common house. So to get your mail, you got to go to the common house every day. And then in the process of everybody coming together to go to the common house, they cross each other and they have these little spontaneous meetings. So our spontaneous meetings is because many of the houses here do not have washers and dryers. They've converted their garage into bedrooms, and they don't have room for washers and dryers in our small little houses. So we have a common washer-dryer facility. On another house that the community controls as a rental is the clotheslines, a few other houses down. On another house is the kids' play structure. Another house is the trampoline. On another house is the chicken coops. So people wander around because they got to dry their clothes, or their kids want to jump on the trampoline, or they got to collect the eggs, or they got to do something. And then there's this wandering around between the backyards. And that allows for the spontaneous interactions that co-housing is trying to encourage. I think we have something like 8 kids and 40 adults. And then we have neighboring houses that are non-member participants. And there's another 4 or 5 kids on that, and another half a dozen to 10 additional adults. So we're closing in on what the studies say is about 60 adults. 60 people is about as big as a community should get, because it gets much larger than that. And people can't remember everybody. We helped a lot of co-ops start, our little successful student co-op. And we were successful because we had lived together before, and we knew what the deal was, what you had to do to live in our house. You had to be a super worker at the Davis Food Co-op. You had to be a vegetarian. You had to cook for us one night a week. You had to be there for dinners. You had to be at the weekly meeting. You had to do your chores. And once that, you know, was established as what the ground rules were, for the next 10 years, people moved into the co-op, knew that that's what the rules were, and they agreed to it. And you couldn't play country music in the living room. So with those as kind of the parameters, we had a great co-op house. Now, the difference between a co-op and a co-housing community is, in co-housing, similar concept of feed each other. Because one of the great things of a co-op house is you come home from school and you've got this great dinner that somebody's cooked for you, and there's probably leftovers the next day. Well, in a co-housing community in our prime, we were running four nights a week where people were cooking for each other. And gosh, you got kids. We had 18 kids in the community and all these working adults. And come home to have somebody have a dinner ready for you for a few dollars and all you had to do was wash your plate was a great deal. So that's kind of the similarities. We feed each other. We work with each other. But we do not go, we don't have the rights to go into each other's houses and, you know, those kinds of things. And N Street doesn't have a legal structure. There is no homeowners association. It's a voluntary dues paying. So everybody holds their own deeds. One of our guiding principles is your house, it's your yard. We can't tell you what to do with your house and your yard. The other joke is that, man, there's a lot of weeds in here. You cannot force your neighbor to weed their yard, but you can go volunteer and weed it for them. There are some houses in the neighborhood who have fences in their front yard, but the vast majority of them, there is no fences in the front yard that are anything like a protective wall, right? So, you know, fences are walls to protect you. Their fences are to protect your cattle from getting into your neighbor's yard and ruining their whole gardens and their, you know, so fences are make good neighbors for a variety of reasons. But a lack of fences is an interesting one, right? So you have your kids and people are wary about having their kids play out in the front yards like I did in the 1960s. But if you have 15 houses with no backyards and you can run around that entire place and you know your kids are going to stay in the backyard and they got plenty of room to run, well, now you feel much more secure about it. There are so many stories of people trying to form a co-op and trying to get four people who do not have the same values, agree to the same things, and then try to reach consensus about how to run a house. The way I tell people, if you want to form a co-op house, have you and your friend who want to be the leaders of it agree on everything, down to the kind of country music you like played in the common space, and then set those rules clearly, and then select people who want to live with that. Do not try to reach consensus after they've moved in about how to run the house. Tell them how to run the house and see if people will live in that house, and they'll be much more successful at creating a co-op house. So that's part of it. It's just difficult to set up without training. Oh, and to respect people and to try to reach agreements. And it's like, but you do not know these people. You need to set up your basic ground rules. If you are a vegetarian household or a vegan household, you need to tell people that. And don't assume that they're going to be that way or you'll ruin your house. Well, so, you know, various stages of lives provide different benefits. And parents of young kids find this enormously useful. You know, my wife's famous story is right after we moved in, I'm gone and she's having a very difficult time with our 1.5-year-old. And she takes the kid, picks her up, goes to the neighbor's co-op house. And the four women in that house immediately say, oh, great, Kelsey's here. And Kelsey stops all of her complaining and Linda gets a break and somebody else is going to be with that kid. And if you don't have some kind of ability to divert it to a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or somebody, it is a rough life raising kids, even two people on a kid. So the benefit of having a whole fleet of other friends and people in the community who will help you with your kids and take and pay attention to them and know them and play with them, gosh, that is unbelievably beneficial. Then as you get older, you know, you have lifelong friends that you have relationships with and you have, and you know their kids and you get to know their grandkids and you have all these deep-based relationships. Now, we're not yet at the age where, you know, we're, you know, starting to croak too badly, but I imagine that that's the next stage, you know, as we get to that older stage, then we'll have people take care of us as we, as a village would take care of the people in the village who finally get to the end of their lives. So it is a, it's like a village, an old-fashioned village, but the people in the village really care about each other and help each other.
Mending Wall by Robert Frost. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they left not one stone on a stone. But they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows, but here there are no cows? Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only or the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says it again. Good fences make good neighbors.
My name is Emmeline. We are in the basement of my house, trying to be quiet so we don't wake up my toddler. Well, for starters, the one thing that I've always loved about this neighborhood, about our home, was that all of our neighbors feel connected. And when we come outside in our backyards, especially during the pandemic, we always had each other in the backyard to wave, say hi. And when my neighbor moved, we had a new couple, younger couple, move in. And one of the first things he did was talk about replacing the fence. And before, the previous neighbor had a chain link fence, so we could still see and wave, but she could still have her cats, you know, roam and not escape from the yard. And that was really the only purpose of that fence, was to contain her cats, but still be able to see neighbors and interact. And the new neighbor was like, he even texted me the quote, a good fence makes a good neighbor. And I was just like, oh, I just wanted to scream. And we had been texting back and forth because I told him, I was like, you know, I'm okay. If you want to replace the fence, that's all right. I can move my raised bed. I can move my, you know, move my plants and my pavers and everything out of the way, because he doesn't have much left on his property line. So it's really my fence now. So I was like, well, if we're going to do this, can we at least extend it and have it capped off and we'll pay the extra, you know, whatever, so it looks nice. And there, of course, was a misunderstanding. I don't know if he never talked to the fence people or what, but the fence is now too short and it doesn't cap off on my property. No. And now it's a weird, tall, wooden fortress. And my husband and I feel completely disconnected and cut off from all of our neighborhood friends, except for the ones on the other side. He really had it set in his mind, because it was the same fence that he had at his old house, so he wanted to do the same people and the same fence. And he asked, you know, what my thoughts were. And ultimately I was like, you know what, you're paying for it. Like, if you're going to put up a fence anyways, that's okay. And he at least tried to do the kind of fence where it's nice on both sides. And I was like, I respect that. Okay. But yeah, I don't think he ever would have opted for something shorter or see-through. It really seems like he wants his privacy and, like, I don't, they're not as social as the rest of the block, I would say. I've had multiple people, including his tenants, come up to me and tell me how sad they were about the fence and how they're going to miss seeing me and seeing our yard. And it really cracked me up that his tenants said that to me, that they were just, like, so depressed because they, even the previous owner, she's just the opposite. She had native plants and loved to garden and didn't use chemicals or sprays. And so, you know, we were, like, best friends and, like, guerrilla gardened in the alley and, like, so all of a sudden he moves in and he's like, I want my privacy. I want to be shut off. Even his tenants were like, it's a crime what he's doing. And everyone's like, you know, I'm gonna miss being able to see your yard and your plants. And but that's also why I always garden too. It's like to connect with neighbors, but also it's like I love the idea of making my yard beautiful in the purpose that other people can enjoy it as much as I enjoy it, and to make people happy when they see flowers growing or see different kinds of flowers that they've never seen before. And I don't know, so I'm sad. I needed to replace my garden bed because my garden bed was right up to the property line, and Mary Beth was the one who had the idea to do it. The previous owner was to put it right up to the property line, and then I could use her fence to like trailer. As a trellis.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was fun because, like, you know, anything that landed on her side she could have. And so, like, they would always joke around about the cucumbers barren, you know. Well, it's funny, my partner, my husband Jeff, we were talking about fences. And pun intended, we've always been on the fence. For, you know, the reason we like to be able to see our neighbors and, you know, feel like we're still in a community and not closed off like that. But, and if you saw out front, I have, like, very, very low, flimsy, like, snow fencing. It's like the temporary fence. And that was just to contain my fat, lazy pug. And that was the only reason I had it there. But now that we have a child, it's like my idea about fencing is, okay, it's less about closing off from the neighbors and more about how fast he is and how quick he wants to go into the alley. So we're thinking about that as far as, like, safety, and then also if we have a dog, we also have to consider, like, well, that will help contain the dog. Now that there is a fortress on one side, we're thinking, since we have our toddler, we need to keep him contained. We might do some kind of fence on the other side so that I can garden and not worry that our baby's chasing cars.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
But we're trying to decide as far as, like, appearance and what we can afford. And we always liked the lower fences and then the ones with, like, the trellis on top. Mm-hmm. So you can still see through, but
yeah,
it's like, the lattice.
Yeah.
I feel like that fence going up is an end of an era, or end of an era, I should say. And I don't know. It's sad, and it just doesn't feel right having that fence. And then also thinking about fencing on the other side too. But I don't know. We at least would want it to be kinder.
Give me Land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the high-flying city that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the tall concrete. Send me off forever, but I ask you, please, don't fence me in.
This is part four of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided.
I'm Margaret Salome, a person who's lived in a few countries, a few cities. I'm a linguist. I have a PhD in linguistics. I like languages, and I like to think about languages and do my daily activities in more than one language. and speculate on how that makes my life more interesting. That's it. I did research a long time ago in the 90s about minority language retention. So we were referring to minority languages other than the dominant language, which in the U.S. would be English. So I was looking at socioeconomic factors that seem to be determining whether or not Spanish would continue to survive in certain parts of the U.S. or Arabic would continue to survive in certain parts of the U.S. Those were the languages I was looking at. And I mostly based my research on secondary sources and my experiences, but in communities where there was a lot of socioeconomic class language speakers, those languages would stick around and become a part of a normal part of the fabric of the community, which you would expect, in California and Florida. But I also found a lot of commentary on pride, people who take a lot of pride in their language and their culture. That's Arabic, for example, would continue to nurture that language and culture. But that's a separate issue from unease and monolinguality and multilinguality and ease. And, I think these are definite. These things have to be defined a lot more. What is unease and what is monolinguality? And I actually prefer to go, okay, let's look at this do multilingual communities feel more at ease with different ideas or different cultures? Are they more open or are they more tolerant? And I don't think that's true. I come from a community, Miami, right? I grew up there. I lived there in the 70s and 80s. I was a child, a teenager, and a young adult there. It's a really multilingual community. I mean, you can walk down the street in Miami in the center, and hear Spanish and Haitian Creole and English, no problem. You can hear them all mixed up all day long, billboards in all those languages. People do code switching all the time, so they switch off between Creole and English or between Spanish and English, back and forth, back and forth. I just had a conversation today like that with a Dominican guy. And we were just code switching the whole time. And that's really common in Miami. Very multilingual in that sense. But it's also back in the 80s when I lived there, I found it very not a tolerant place at all. Not open at all. Really conservative politically. You really had very segregated, white people in their gated communities and black people have their neighborhoods and Cubans have their neighborhoods and people are always asking you where you were from and if you're this or that or are you Cuban, are you Puerto Rican? Everyone wanted to put you in a box. It's a very segregated, it was and probably still is a really segregated, really conservative place, but very multilingual. Then you could approach the question a different way. If an individual is multilingual, does that individual, not as part of a larger society, but is that individual more open to other ideas or other ways, other perspectives? I think that's an easier question for me personally, I mean, I can speak from my own experiences. Like, yeah, I mean, I think differently in different languages.